How are you doing then? Welcome to Wednesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. It's me, Richie Allen, strangely enough, live from a very horrible, wet and dad disgusting, dirty old town, Salford. No, Salford isn't disgusting. The weather is disgusting. It's pretty awful out there. Nice to be with you, nice. Do drop me a line during the programme with your thoughts. I'm not policing your thoughts on the issues being discussed.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. This is your Richie Allen Show, live from the magnificent city of Salford.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, it's been a very interesting week north of the border in Scotland, hasn't it? The hate crime bill went live. The law went live on Monday. So I've been meaning to invite Stuart Waiton back to the programme. Stuart is a lecturer at Abertay University in Dundee. He's more than that. He's a journalist, he's a criminologist, he's an author, and he's an all-round good guy. He'll be on the programme shortly, around about 25, 28 minutes, to talk about what's been going on there and the implications of it. And a little bit later on, the Irish journalist and writer John Walters, another regular contributor to this programme, you'll probably have heard by now, he's going to stand as an independent candidate in the forthcoming EU elections in Ireland. That would be in June. So John Walters, entering politics. What's going on? Later on in the programme, we will ask that very question of John, and no doubt he'll tell us the answer, because he's a good guy like that. He's one of the good ones too. Yes, horrible today. April showers, I think, have come early. That old cliche, but it's been a rotten old day. Didn't take long. Filthy old day here in the Northwest. Look, dominating broadcast media today, and the, I suppose, you know, we're moving into an era with the broadsheets. I subscribe to the broadsheets, and I send a few bob to The Guardian, because The Guardian isn't behind a paywall, but I can't justify using it and reading it and not sending them something. And that's how I am. And the show, I mean, it's tax. It's written off anyway. Tax deductible. But it's interesting, I haven't purchased a broadsheet newspaper for some time because I use the websites. I pay for the websites. It's an interesting paradigm we're moving into, isn't it? In any case, so yeah, so the news websites and the broadcast media are giving a lot of coverage today to what happened in Gaza yesterday, or what we learned yesterday, what happened in Gaza with seven aid workers murdered. I suppose it's fair to say murdered, not killed, they were murdered by the Israeli Defence Force. Now, pressure, according to the BBC, is mounting on Israel. I mean, I just don't believe this. Israel is as Israel does. Pressure, there isn't any pressure on Israel. Anyway, says the BBC, after the seven who were working for the food aid charity World Central Kitchen, they were killed in this strike. Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu said, it happens in war. There isn't a war in Gaza. That's another misnomer or another distortion of the facts. I probably could find the time to get into that, but I won't. I'll leave it alone today. It happens in war, he said, and a thorough inquiry was being conducted to prevent a recurrence. This is nonsense. It is deliberate. That was a deliberate strike. And we'll have a look at why in a moment. The head of the Israeli military said the strike was a grave mistake, yada, yada, yada. Now, there are concerns about aid supplies in Gaza because some charities, understandably concerned about the well-being of their staff, have paused operations while they reassess the situation there. More information about those killed has emerged today. Three British nationals have been named as John Chapman, James Henderson and James Kirby. They were working as security advisors for the charity. Palestinian, Polish, Australian and American-Canadian citizens were among were the other victims, effectively. So weapons sales to Israel then. Rather amazingly, here's a Jabba the Hutt, Nick Ferrari, on LBC Radio this morning. Now, strong warning here, this might very well, well, to be crude about it, this might boil your piss somewhat.
Certainly I'm a friend of Jewish people, which I suppose makes me a friend of Israel. And sometimes it takes a friend to tell a friend where they're going wrong. And that is this moment.
So here is where Nick Ferrari chooses to make a stand on the violence in Gaza. Here, today, because three Britons are amongst those killed in the aid convoy. Let's hear a bit more. This is where he's chosen to make his stand.
This is indefensible. I've made a point of actually getting in a little earlier than usual to read as much as I possibly can.
I mean, he must know that for nearly 6 months now, the Israelis have been murdering children. I mean, deliberately murdering children. We'll come to that in a moment as well. Doctors in Gaza from all over the world, Canada, from America, are saying they're shooting children. Now, he must know this because he's in a newsroom in Leicester Square in London. But this is where he chooses to make his stand. This is indefensible, presumably, and it's probably unfair to put any words in his mouth. But what has gone before is defensible.
About the events that led to the death of these seven aid workers. And every single fact is horrific. Not least the vehicles, as I think you probably all know, because you'll have seen in newspaper photographs or on TV. They're all clearly displayed as carrying aid workers. They have the various emblems and everything else. Did you know they're also operating on routes that are approved by the Israeli Defence Forces? So these are routes that they know these vehicles go down to facilitate aid getting into Gaza. So they're clearly marked vehicles on pre-designated routes. And supposedly, we're told the precision of the Israeli military, which we're meant to believe is one of the greatest on earth, with three separate strikes, with time apart from them, authorised, again, I read, but needs a senior military figure, it needs a military lawyer, whatever that is, it needs an area commander, and still this went ahead?
Yeah, because they deliberately murdered those aid workers. What part of it do you not understand? There's no case to answer here. And then he goes on.
So, from one friend to another, this has to stop. And I would suggest that at the very least, when you consider that it is possible, I don't know anything about drone missiles, but presumably it's possible the missiles that we sell to Israel have just killed three of our own citizens, along with four other innocent workers.
Yeah, it's also quite possible that the guns and the tanks and the airplanes that you gave the Israeli government may very well have played some part in the slaughter of over 15,000 children, Nick. But here is where he decides to make a stand. This is where he decides it's time to say enough is enough. When seven aid workers, including three British lads, are murdered by the Israelis. Today is the day. Not over the last 5 months.
All of the Britons, I understand, who've served in the military, some with a degree of distinction, and it could have been our own missiles that killed them?
Yeah.
I would suggest now is the time that we suspend. Temporarily.
Temporarily? Let's suspend, but temporarily?
Temporarily.
Temporarily.
Suspend the sale of arms to Israel.
Right.
Because some message has to get through.
Right. Enough's enough now. This is the final straw. They've killed three Britons. Forget about the 15,000 children they've killed. The 35,000 and counting that we know of, Palestinians that have been murdered by them. And you know, I was listening to a guy speaking on Times Radio earlier, and he was saying, in the coming months, whenever this stops, please God, this will stop soon, and they begin to try and clean up Gaza, they're going to find thousands of bodies. So it's going to be 50 or 60,000 people. They've eliminated, they've destroyed with weapons made in this country and in other Western democracies. And this is where he chooses to make his stand, Nick Ferrari, because three Britons were killed. What a bastard. Let's listen to Jan Engeland. Jan Engeland is the General Secretary of Norway's Refugee Council. He's on BBC News today, and he pulls no punches, Jan Engeland.
Not very surprised. It seems the world is surprised, but listen, 200 Palestinian aid workers were already killed. 170 from the UN, 30 from the Palestinian Red Crescent. Many NGOs have seen attacks. Gaza has world record in killed children, killed women, all innocent, killed teachers, killed nurses, doctors, and journalists. So, on top of that, world record in killing of aid workers, these were internationals, and that's why they got all of this attention. But it's equally horrific when Palestinian colleagues are killed.
Jan Engeland making the point, the media is only interested because these were international aid workers. Now, Nick Ferrari is a coward, but he's not on his own, to be fair to him. We can't single him out. Every broadcaster in this country is a coward because they know that a number of doctors, reputable doctors, have come out and said in the last 36 hours that they have an abundance of evidence of Israeli snipers deliberately shooting children as young as 7 or 8 years of age. So The Guardian has picked up on this today. I mentioned it in the papers. Dr. Fozia Alvi, Canadian doctor, has been talking about it. Sniper shots to the brain, meeting children, being kept alive by breathing tubes, but their lives are gone. Paraplegic now. 9 doctors gave The Guardian accounts of working in Gaza hospitals this year. All but one of them, foreign volunteers, reporting a steady stream of children with single bullet wounds to the head or the chest. Some of them said, these doctors, that the types and the locations of these wounds led them to believe the victims were directly targeted by Israeli troops. Directly targeted. Hugely troubled by the number of kids severely wounded or killed by single gunshots, sometimes by high caliber bullets, causing extensive damage to young bodies. And the cowardice of the media today. Not a single broadcaster has picked up on this story and spoken of it, or even asked somebody from the Israeli government to put up a spokesperson to account for it. Is it true that your soldiers are shooting children dead in Gaza deliberately? It's horrendous. And Nick Ferrari decides it's time now to make a stand and to temporarily, hilariously, suspend arms deals or arms sales or even gifts of arms to Israel. What a bastard. And I'm not being unfair. What a bastard. What a useless fat bastard he is. How could you even look yourself in the mirror? Anyway, let's talk briefly about lockdown legacy because, well, the hits just keep on coming. It was said, wasn't it, last year, 5 million people, 6 million people, 7 million. They couldn't make their minds up how many people have been waiting a very long time for treatment in UK hospitals or exploratory procedures, tests, scans, whatnot. They're now saying, the Office of National Statistics is saying, that the waiting list could be 2 million longer than previously thought. Imagine it. They reckon 10 million now, more than 1 in 5 people in the UK, are waiting for an NHS appointment. When they extrapolate their own findings right across the country, it's nearly 10 million. It's 1 in 5 people now. There's your lockdown legacy. There's the legacy of deliberately censoring doctors, scientists, nurses, surgeons back in spring of 2020 who said lockdown is unnecessary, COVID is not serious enough, and the implications of lockdown over the next few years are going to be devastating for the public health situation here in the UK. Now we're seeing it again today. The ONS comes out and says, you know what? It's 10 million people now. How many people do you think are going to die because of that? And any of the 10 million might be waiting for a scan that might show up some cancer, or a scan that might show that they might need a valve put in an aorta, or they might need a stent in their heart, or they might need something, but in the meantime might die. There's your lockdown legacy. I suppose there's always room, in all of the darkness, there's always room for a bit of humour, isn't there? There's always room for a bit of humour. I don't know if you came across this today, but I had to do a double take. A non-binary patient, right, in Canada. Patient makes me laugh because there's nothing wrong with this person apart from, you know, a massive case, a massive infection of narcissism. A non-binary patient in Canada wants the taxpayer to fund surgery to create a vagina for him, but he also wants to keep his penis and for it to be functional too.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Well, non-binary patient wants a vagina and a penis, and because the dickhead was told, no, you're not, we don't blow or waste or squander taxpayers' money on building you a vagina and so you can keep your functional penis, he sued the government, effectively. So if a court rules in this dipstick's favour, this bloke, because he is a bloke, there's no such thing as non-binary, who's from Ontario, will then travel to a specialist clinic in Austin, Texas. And I couldn't help laughing when I read that, of all the places. And at this specialist clinic, they'll build a vagina for the bloke, but they'll make sure that his penis is nice and functional as well. The obvious gag, it's dangling in the air, I've got to say it is. I suppose he wants to be in a position that when he's told to go and fuck himself, he'll be able to demonstrate it. All right then, as he unzips his jeans. This is crazy. He's being discriminated against. There's a good chance he'll win too, apparently. Ontario's health insurance plan denied this guy's request for this ridiculous surgery on the grounds that it's experimental, but he's suing them for discrimination. And he should be allowed to have the vaginoplasty, and that it having the vaginoplasty shouldn't inherently include a penectomy. Jesus. Yeah, I have a right to have a vagina built and to keep me penis. Do you understand? You discriminating bastards, you, is what he's saying. LGBTQ rights group Eagle or Egale Canada, it's got to be Egale, they said that the health insurance company's interpretation of a vaginoplasty is exclusionary and discriminates against non-binary people on the basis of their gender identity.
What kind of fuckery are we?
Yeah, yeah. He should be allowed to have a vagina built and keep his penis because he's non-binary, you see. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Made me laugh out loud today, that. The nonsense they're putting up with. How much is it costing the taxpayer to put the court case on? Because the taxpayer is presumably funding the defence. Or maybe even this guy's costs. Maybe, I don't know. Let's leave it. Let's leave it for now. Hate crime law that's come in Scotland. We'll be talking with Stuart about this shortly. Stuart Waiton. I mean, as if this wasn't predicted. As if a million people didn't say this. Humza Yousaf, who's a complete and utter idiot, right? And he is the First Minister of Scotland. This monumental, don't swear again. This guy, Humza Yousaf, he said, when we bring in this dangerous, dystopian, crazy law, he said, don't worry about it. We won't have any nuisance, abuse of it at all. The police will not be snowed under. Don't worry about it. It's not going to happen, he said. Well, a Scottish minister admitted today that the hate crime law has prompted nuisance complaints and vexatious claims are being made to the police under the new law which came in on Monday.
Surprise, surprise. The unexpected hits you between the eyes.
Yeah, Siobhan Brown, the community safety minister, said she was surprised to receive a call from Police Scotland about a complaint made under the legislation. She said, and this is why she was on the radio. She was complained, apparently. And her office number was given. But then she had to concede in the interview that, yeah, this is proof that people are making fake and vexatious complaints under this controversial legislation, even though the First Minister of Scotland had insisted earlier there was no evidence to support warnings as there would be a large increase in the number of vexatious complaints. There you are. Scottish Tories reckon 1.4 million complaints could be made in the first year of this crazy legislation if the current rate continues. Let's listen to Sue Smith. Sue Smith. Susan Smith, she is the director of Four Women Scotland. And she was speaking today to Times Radio. Stig Abel is the guy. You will hear his question, then her answer.
Is there an upside here that we just need to be honest about as well? You might have a trans...
An upside now to the new hate speech law. Is there an upside to it? Can't see one myself, but let's hear Stig's question then.
To be honest about as well, you might have a transgender person living quietly in Scotland, trying to have their life, being subject to abuse, people stirring up hatred in the terms of the new act. They now get better protection. Someone will be better protected today than they would have been at the end of March. That's a good thing, isn't it?
I'm not sure they are better protected. I mean, actual crime has always been illegal, and we had a hate crime aggravator which covered transgender people before this was brought in. This stirring up part, I think, is going to be really hard to prove and really hard to prosecute, and that doesn't mean that people aren't going to be investigated. So I think there's going to be a lot of disappointed people on both ends. There's going to be people who have a terrible time while the police undertake an investigation, and there's going to be people who decide that the law is toothless and it's not doing what they were promised, or that over promised by some of the groups and organizations who got the Scottish government to put this in. You know, right at the beginning of this, when the Scottish government did flirt briefly with bringing in greater protections for free speech, there was an absolute outcry from people who wanted to use this and weaponize this law to go after people and settle scores. And I'm not sure how that will make the life of an individual better, because I think all this does is ramp up an already febrile situation. I think that's going to make their lives worse.
No. It's going to make their lives worse, said Susan Smith. She's the director of Four Women Scotland. It is coming up for 22 minutes past the hour. Good evening to Emma, who found that very funny. The non-binary dude who wants a vaginoplasty, but also wants to retain his tallywhacker. Madness, isn't it? How does that nonsense even, you know... Why? No, you... I mean, why? How is it that they cannot say, no, you don't get to sue us for discrimination? You're just not having both. If you want the vaginoplasty because you're, you know, you've got gender dysphoria and you're being treated for that, we understand it. You want, you're a transsexual, then we'll do that. But we'll obviously lop off your lad, your meat and two veg. And he says, no, I mean, it is a bit silly, all right, no doubt about this. Yeah, a number of you saying yes, absolutely mental. And Jan asks a very good question. Where are they going to put it? Brilliant question. Not the only one. G-Man says, Richie, where is he going to fit it all in? Genuinely, where's the space? I'm racking my brains. I'm picturing, I never thought in a... three-decade career I would ever say live on radio is that I am picturing my own penis right now. But I am. I'm imagining it. I'm not touching it. I'm working. And I'm fully dressed, of course, as you'd expect me to be, a professional radio presenter. I'm imagining where a vagina would be placed while retaining my penis. Unless they're going to move the penis slightly north, maybe, towards his belly button, maybe. It's absolutely ridiculous, isn't it? It's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. Here's music for you from Bruce the Boss Springsteen. And when we come back, Stuart Waiton will be on a little bit later on. John Waters. It's the Richie Allen Show. Hello, Sunshine, from Bruce Springsteen, from an album called Western Stars, which is a delight. It is 27 and a half minutes past the hour. Lots of messages coming in on this particular subject. The subject of Scotland's hate speech laws. I did see an interesting, or hear an interesting interview earlier today with an academic who said that by not arresting J.K. Rowling, the author, by not arresting her for misgendering three or four, I can't remember, trans women, the Scottish police have demonstrated that there is basically no need for people to be panicking, that they basically had honoured that which they had claimed prior to the law going live, where they said people shouldn't worry about being arrested for name-calling. This isn't going to happen, they said. And it's being claimed by some supporters of this new law in Scotland that, well, the police basically demonstrated that J.K. Rowling made the Scottish government's case for them by carrying on Twitter, and the Scottish police said, we're not interested. But then there were others who said today, maybe the Scottish police mightn't go after J.K. Rowling because she's very, very, very high profile, right? But that doesn't mean they wouldn't go after somebody who might misgender somebody on Twitter or on TikTok, but who doesn't have a public profile or who wouldn't be as well known. I'll put that very question in a moment to Stuart Waiton from the Scottish Union for Education. In fact, we'll get him on now. Stuart is the secretary of the Scottish Union for Education, a board member. He's also, of course, a criminologist, a lecturer, a author and journalist. And he's following this situation in Scotland. Obviously, he's there. But the Scottish Union for Education have been watching this very closely. Let's welcome back to the programme our friend Stuart Waiton. Stuart, welcome back and thanks again for taking the call.
Yeah, no bother. I'm not in prison yet, so we're fine so far.
You're fine so far. Well, let's start with that then, because you didn't hear my introduction. A politician or an academic, I can't remember, said, and this is somebody who supports the new law in Scotland, said that J.K. Rowling made the Scottish government's case for them when she ranted about trans people and misgendered them, and the police said, we're not interested, we're not going to be pursuing J.K. Rowling, thus proving what Humza Yousaf, the Scottish First Minister, had said, and that was people will not be arrested or badgered for name-calling or petty insults or whatever. What do you say to that?
Well, I say J.K. Rowling is a billionaire and they're terrified of her. I'm not sure that we could... you know, if I said something like that, or Joe Bloggs round the corner said, come and get me, you might find something quite different. I mean, part of the problem with this, because I'm trying to look at the wording in the law, what people are saying about it. I mean, it seems quite contradictory. On the, it's like we're going to take an easy-ozy approach and all the rest of it. As far as I can see, if there is political pressure on the government and the police, then they back down, right? But that demonstrates the problem, which is that this law is politics, right? By other means, by which I mean, if, you know, so what happens in 6 months' time when the pressure eases off and the police and the bureaucrats just start to carry things through? Because one of the framing of law, which has often been the case, is they say this will be a crime only if a reasonable person thinks that this is threatening or abusive and so on. Two problems with that. The first is that what is deemed threatening today is getting broader and broader, right? So you're threatening by raising your voice almost amongst certain people or expressing an opinion and so on. So we start to get the argument that words are violence today, and we even get the idea that silence is violence. Yeah. Right? The sort of activists that make these points, they mean it, right? And if they had their way, they would potentially criminalize silence. I mean, who knows if they're serious about it. I mean, I don't tend to find them particularly serious in terms of actually what they argue. So that's the first thing. People, the framing of law is increasingly being developed by the most thin-skinned, chronically offended sensibility. That's a problem, right? So in terms of what we mean by reasonable person. The second one is that historically, the idea of the reasonable person, it worked when there was a common culture. Right? It worked when, so the idea, that the way it was presented was, It needs to be reasonable to the man on the Clapham omnibus, right? That's the way it was presented, right? The normal guy who's on a bus, who's got a normal, sensible sensibility and, you know, values that are common and collective. We no longer have values that are common and collective. Right? We have elite values and elite perception, which is based on this idea that people are very vulnerable and that particularly groups need to be protected and so on. And also the perception that a lot of the rest of the population are hate-filled, right? I mean, that's one of the vile things about this act, is that it's predicated on the idea that Scottish people are essentially bigoted scumbags, right? And that's what should be spelt out all the more, I think, because it represents itself in such a cozy way. But actually what the people like Humza Yousaf are saying is, Scottish people are scumbags, they're backward, they're prejudiced, and we need to change the culture, right? That's what they say all the time when they're developing new laws. We need to change the culture, i.e. your culture is a problem, and we need to change it.
Let me challenge. Something you said there, Stuart. Sorry to interrupt you, and you know you'll have loads of time now.
Yeah.
I want to challenge you. Humza Yousaf would say, if he was here, he would say, I have never said any such thing that Scottish people are bigoted and scumbags. He would say, what I am trying to do here, he would say, is the rules of engagement, not the rules, but the way we communicate has changed. And we see people now doing things online that they would never dare do in person because there are consequences to screaming abuse at somebody in person. And people are increasingly taken to Twitter and Facebook and Instagram to throw the most vile insults at people. And that whether we like to acknowledge it or not everybody is as tough as the next guy. And that these insults and these constant barrages of abuse can have a very serious impact on somebody's mental health. And therefore, that is why I'm doing this. It's not because I think the Scots are bigoted scumbags. It's because something is happening. There is a phenomenon since the growth of Twitter and social media, and we need to address it. That's what he would say.
Well, he might say that one thing. I mean, to start with, I'd be able to point out Scottish government documents. I think I might have mentioned last time I was on that talk about we need children and human rights so that we can unlearn the prejudices of past generations.
Yeah.
Right. So they print this stuff quite happily. Right. They develop a misogyny working group to look at whether we should have misogyny laws. And Holyrood itself, that's the actual parliament, said we need to do this through a gendered lens, i.e. a very particular feminist perspective, which often looks at the whole idea of patriarchy, toxic masculinity, and so on. So again, I think I could provide all sorts of evidence to show that actually they look at people through various ideological prisms where they think you are bigots, right? Why else do you need anti-racism in every subject in schools, right? Why do you need maths anti-racism lessons unless you think kids are racist scumbags and their parents are, and you need to get them young, right? So I think it's just not true, and I think I could provide plenty of evidence for that. With the Twitter stuff, you know, it's like, again, where is this, right? Where is all this super vile abuse? Is there millions of it, right? So I'll give you an example. The England football team, when they missed the penalties, right? So they missed the penalties, and then there was a bit of an uproar about that there's all these tweets and so on, stuff online saying racist things, right? Well, you actually look into that, and the initial burst, I think there was about, it was something like, it was maybe 100 tweets or something, right? And I calculated this was a match that was more watched by more people in the UK than any other television programme ever. Right?
Yeah.
This was the England
final. Yeah.
Italy.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So this is, you're talking about 25, 30 million people, whatever it was, massive, right? So you work it out by then 100, and you're talking about 0.00000000, you know, it goes on and on and on, 1% of the population. So this mass racist outburst, which was presented, was all over the media. Everyone heard about it. The Marcus Rashford mural was thrown up, even though it then turns out the Marcus Rashford mural being defaced didn't have anything racist about it. It was just some anti-Man U guy probably being a dick. So even there, right, so we get a really well-known example of apparently this mass problem. And a lot of these tweets came from abroad. So where is it true, right? Is it true? Is everybody now they're often saying things? It might be true, right? I'm sure there's lots of people say stupid things on Twitter. Don't read it, right? I'm sure there's loads of people say stupid things about me. I don't read it. You don't have to read them, right? What you actually find is people go searching for it so that they can then report.
And then report on
it. So this idea, you know, this idea, this kind of like, you know, as if they can't escape the mass attack on social media and all the rest of it. Is it actually true? I'm not even sure if it is true, even at that most basic level. And even if it is, ignore it. Words are words. We need to get back to the idea that there is a difference between words and actions. People say horrible, stupid things. Twitter, in fact, there was a famous director once said, Twitter is a garbage, you know, is a garbage can. So, you know, if you jump in a garbage can, you expect to come out covered in crap, right? Yeah, because people just spout crap on Twitter. That's what they do, right? That seems to be what part of the whole Twitter thing is people just hurl insults and all the rest of it. I've been called bigot. You know, I was at, when I organised a meeting in Dundee to discuss the transgender stuff in school, there's people standing outside, Stuart Waiton is a bigot. I've had students ask for me to be sacked because I'm so-called a bigot. I have complaints made against me, which will then possibly end up being on the hate crime police register. Who knows, right? Deal with it, right? It's tough. Life is tough sometimes. People have moronic ideas. We need to learn to have a backbone. We have to, because if we don't, all you end up is deciding different people will decide different things need to be policed, and you no longer have a free society.
Stuart Waiton is our guest. Stuart is a board member. You're the secretary, Stuart, isn't that right, of the Scottish Union for Education. I should know this because I do read the Substack. Get on scottishunionforeducation.substack.com. We're talking about Monday's, the going live, as it were, of Scotland's new hate crime laws, and they are pretty sinister. Look, listeners are asking me to ask you. It's a live radio show, obviously. So they're saying, Richie, will you put this to Stuart? And a number of listeners have asked the same question, amazingly, phrased differently. But is it possible under this new law that people with so-called protected characteristics might be embroiled in a row about something that's got nothing to do with their protected characteristics? They could be arguing with you over whether Scotland should be independent or not, or arguing about the merits or the demerits of Brexit. And if it got very heated, they could make a complaint to their local police station and say that the anger or the vitriol was motivated by your prejudice or my prejudice against their protected characteristic. I mean, could it be as ridiculous as this?
It could be, but I do think, so because of the opposition to the law, even the existing law, I think the police are a little bit cautious, which is good, because they should be.
As they should be.
I mean, it took them 3 years to introduce it. You know what I mean? It's like, how bad can a law be that it takes 3 years to actually, for the police to decide they can actually implement it? So that is possible, and your listeners are right to raise the point about people of certain characteristics, because this is represented as it's political. It's a political act which is quite clearly got an eye on certain people, right? So one of the things it said, one of the stupid, I mean, there's been one stupid activity after another, but one of the things that they said when the police wrote about how 18 to 30 year old young white disadvantaged men are the most likely people to be hate, and you know, there's an addiction to hate, and you know, it doesn't do you any good, blah blah blah, and all the rest of it. So clearly this law isn't about protecting young poor working class men. It's actually about seeing the need to police young white working class men. And I mean, this isn't new, Right, so we had a case a few years ago, a guy called Stephen Birrell, who went on Twitter and said, oh, all Celtic fans, screw you, hope you all die, catty farming, blah, 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 right? So yeah, spout yeah. This. He got 8 months in prison, right? 8 months in prison for spouting off some anti-Celtic, anti-Catholic yeah. garbage,
it's
right?
Madness,
now, yeah. He's an idiot. It was partly to do with the fact that he had previous convictions, so it wasn't just the thing itself. But the whole framing of this is highly political and becomes a form of speech crime. And you don't know what will be, you know, I mean, look how mad the world is now. But if I'd met you in a pub 10 years ago and someone chirped up and said, oh, if you say, hello, ladies and gentlemen, you could be potentially committing a crime. You would have, I mean, we would have laughed and just said, that's never going to happen. That's yeah. ridiculous. Don't be so stupid. What's going to happen in 2 years' time, 4 years' time? I mean, you've got no idea where this is going to go, and the framework is there. But what will happen is that, at least in theory, if the police follow their correct procedure, those complaints will be logged as non-crime hate incidents, at the very least, which will mean they go on your record. And then if you apply for a job as a teacher, of a youth worker, doctor, almost any job where, you know, you come into contact with what are called vulnerable groups, you'll not get the job, right? And that's the same for people like me and other students at this university, lots of other universities who are jumping in, getting in on the act. Complaints will now be increasingly logged, sent to the police. The police will logically record them. And you could end up becoming unemployable based on an allegation that there's no evidence at all. And which has changed in England a little bit, because they've changed this after Harry Miller and the Fair Cop protest against it. But in Scotland, they haven't changed it, of course. They're just carrying on with recording non-crime hate incidents, which are usually, well, as they say, it's not a crime. And I suspect most of the time it's got nothing to do with hate either. So you end up...
Yeah, and nothing to do with the police.
Crazy situation.
And the Home Office announced on Monday, I believe, I covered it on Tuesday, in England and Wales, that despite telling police forces not to be going out to neighbourhood disputes where I call you a Geordie dipstick over the wall and you say, shut up, you paddy bastard, you're always pissed, and we have a row. Not to be going out to that they are not only still going out to these incidents while they're not investigating burglaries, funnily enough, and that's staggering that they were told not to do it and they're continuing to do it. Can I ask you this? Learned men and women over the years, going way back, have come on this programme and said, Richie, ultimately Western democracies love China's social credit model. They love it. They want to basically, once we move beyond cash, which it looks like we're going to be gone, cash will be gone in 2 or 3 years. And when everything you do is basically observed one way or another by the state, that your access to services maybe... entertainment maybe might be curtailed in the future if you're deemed to be even temporarily a bad citizen. Again, something we might have laughed at in the pub 10 years ago, but China operates that very system. It does. They'd love it here, wouldn't they?
Well, they'd love it in Scotland.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I think England still, although once you get a Labour government, that, you know, that might change very quickly, but England still have some slight barriers against this stuff, whereas Scotland don't. Right? Scotland don't, because of the nature of politics here is that there's no conservatism, there's no old school types. Everyone is bought into the new agenda. So anything is possible in Scotland, because once you establish a morality around protecting the vulnerable, which they have done, and once you're only talking to yourselves in an echo chamber, then of course all we're trying to do is protect people. You know, we're just trying to do what's right for the vulnerable. You know, surely you should be able to see that. You know, if you don't change your behaviour, then why should society allow you? Blah blah blah. The possibilities are endless. And that's the thing. The more we describe people as vulnerable and the more we think of people as being vulnerable, the more we move to a situation where we're going to police and regulate more and more things and more aspects of life. And that's the trajectory that we're going down at the minute, which is, I mean, this new law is a perfect illustration of it.
It is. Stephen Jones is a Labour shadow minister. He was on, he was put out to do the media round today, and it's just come to me. I'm going to impress you one way or the other today. It's just come to my mind because you mentioned, didn't you, Labour? Yes, I would agree with you. It'll be on steroids if Labour get in. But this guy, Stephen Jones, told Kay Burley on Sky News this morning that the Labour Party is not interested in this Scottish law or introducing a similar law. But, of course, you have the online harms bill here in the UK, and that's got statutory instruments attached to it, meaning that it can be changed or amended at any time in the future without there being any need for a debate or another vote. So this is interesting. I'd like to take you back to something, because you're listening to Stuart Waiton, a criminologist, author, lecturer, journalist, got a lot of caps, does Stuart, and secretary for the Scottish Union for Education. Now, you said to me a few minutes ago, silence is violence. I don't have many moments, me. I'm a pretty run-of-the-mill bloke, right? Once in a blue moon, I have a moment. A few years ago, I was in the middle of a rant on this programme, and I was thinking about this paradigm. I had an idea that there might be a paradigm. There might be a time in the future when remaining silent and not offering an opinion might become difficult, or it might be frowned upon by society, and pressure might be brought to bear on people. And I talked about how, for years growing up in Ireland, you know, people quite rightly kept their opinions to themselves on certain issues when they just didn't want to share their opinions. And fair enough. I'm not interested in that, Richie. I don't have any opinion at all. And they might do, but they might think, no, I'm not going to share it. And I thought about this long and hard, and I thought, yeah, I could see a time when you might not be in a position to say, well, actually, I'll keep my thoughts to myself on that, thank you. And the reason I ranted about this, allyships had become a big thing. My missus had been asked, she works for a very famous global accountancy firm, right? And she'd been asked, would she sit in on a Zoom call with some LGBT colleagues whom she'd never met, didn't work in her department, but so that she could hear about their lived experiences. My missus is a hard-as-nails French woman, Stuart. My missus said, fuck off, in no uncertain terms. And I heard her say, fuck off. She said, no. And the idea was that this would be good for her, you know, as a straight white French woman. And she said to me, I wonder, Richie, will a time come when you won't be able to absent yourself from that? And you talked about silence is violence. That's a coming thing too, isn't it? Where it just won't be accepted or tolerated to say, well, actually, I'd rather keep my thoughts private on that, thank you. Well, you must be a bigot then.
Yeah, well, it keeps pushing, because you're now getting this thing about forced speech, which you're getting around pronouns. So, you know, it's not just that what you say becomes censored, but you must say something that you disagree with, right? You must relate to every, you know, person that says they're a woman as a woman or a man as a man, even if that doesn't fit how you see it or the perspective, or it's a mistake or whatever it is, you have to actually actively say it. But similarly in workplaces, you're now having to be actively anti-racist. It's not just being against racism. Employers are now having to be actively anti-racist, show that they're anti-racist. And that's what you get awards now in universities, this kind of bronze, gold, silver anti-racist award. And universities spend months and months and months trying to develop ways to show that they're being actively anti-racist. And you know, that then filters down into lecturers, potentially into terms of what you should be teaching and what books you should be reading, and are you decolonizing yourself and so on. So it is becoming a kind of a much more oppressive framework, not just punishing you for saying things, but actually punishing you for not doing what is the new accepted, correct kind of value system, if you like, that's being introduced essentially everywhere.
A friend of mine has young a kid at primary school and told me something that he couldn't have known, that it was something that I had previously been told by a listener, because my friend doesn't listen to me. He's not much of a friend then, but no, he's a good friend. He doesn't listen to the show. And he said, Richie, my young lad has been asked to take part in a couple of stay-in lunches where they stay in. And it's to talk about gender and, you know, how to deal with your gay and lesbian classmates. And these are 10-year-olds. And that's kind of part of this, isn't it? Well, that's a conditioning thing, to condition kids that, yeah, you've got to participate. Whereas we would say, I couldn't give a shite, like, what somebody's sexuality is. And that's for them to deal with and to live with. It's not for me. But this notion that kids should have to congregate at lunchtime and talk about this is, it's paving the way for you must participate. You must be involved in this. And absenting yourself from it might lead somebody to think that maybe you're harbouring hatred towards those people because you don't want to listen to them.
It is, but I mean, it's exactly this. I mean, it's such an unpleasant... I mean, I've made these points to you before in the past about if you look at serious surveys about things like racism, Britain's never been less racist, right? And it's... I mean, these are serious pieces of research, not the kind of advocacy research done by kind of vulnerable groups who desperately try to find hate. But these are the groups that politicians, especially in Scotland, look to sort of get their information, whether it's about transgenderism and so on. So the Scottish transgender policy for schools is developed through consultation with transgender lobby groups, right, who do research, which is, you know, essentially garbage research that no serious social scientist would accept. And then they develop policies. And then they say, right, this is the correct thing you need to be incorporated in this, you need to have these correct values. And absolutely within schools, this is what's happening. So it becomes schools in Scotland openly promote themselves as promoters of social justice. Right? That's what they say education is about, social justice. And it has become the new type of morality. And the zealots and the activists who are pushing this carry people with them, because most people think, well, I want to be nice. You know, I don't want to like be unpleasant to gay people, trans people, black people. I mean, you know, I believe in equality and so on. So they use the sort of goodwill of people to horseshoe in and incorporate this new, very different and really degraded type of ideology, which, I mean, the word hate, I hate the word hate.
Yeah, me and all.
Because it's so... It's so subjective, it's so polemical. I mean, the term, just to bore you for a second, but the hate crime framework developed out of America in the 1980s. Right? And basically, you had left-wing liberal people who, partly because they saw themselves failing politically, because this is like Ronald Reagan's been elected again, Margaret Thatcher's getting elected, the right seemed to be on the rise. They're becoming very concerned because they think, oh, the left's losing. There's a rise of racism. We've got to do something about it. So they say, well, what we need to do is we need to monitor hate. And what they were specifically talking about was groups like the Ku Klux Klan, right? Because they thought that, you know, you're going to get these far-right extremist groups organizing. And you could arguably say these sort of individuals do hate black people, right? I mean, it's still a bit of a childish use of language, but, you know, you could at least make that argument. And that's where it comes from. And then it expands from a concern about the most extreme, often violent, organized groups of people. And then it just spreads out. So everybody now, right, children who call each other stupid names are categorized as being filled with hate. And that is then promoted by the police. And the horrible thing is if you ask young people in particular, but if you ask the public in general, but young people in particular, do you think there is a problem with hate in society? They'll very often say, yes. You ask them, do you have hate?
Yeah.
Are you racist? And they'll say no, right? But they think that other people do. Because this is the whole image that's being projected back into society by the same elites who think that people are like this. And they're not. They're not like this.
No,
people
and you know
are
something.
Generally good.
And you know something, Stuart? The state should have no part to play in... The state should have no jurisdiction over what a person hates and doesn't hate. Like you mentioned the Ku Klux Klan. You know, I interviewed some of these morons over the years, David Duke, infamously a few years ago on this very programme. And he bored me to tears. He was so idiotic anyway. But I turned him inside out, you know, and that wasn't difficult, to be honest. I'm not picking myself up here. But a moron, right? But laws existed. So when the hatred for black people moved into we're going to blow up a church, or laws existed, in most cases, thankfully, these people were found, were put on trial and were sentenced to prison sentences for very, very long terms. Others were executed, not that I agree with that. But this idea that you could police somebody's feelings, you know, yes, we are. We will encounter at some time or another in our lives somebody who has a view that we might find silly or even repugnant. But as long as they're not acting on that view, it's nobody's business. And that is my opinion on it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it is concerning. It's because obviously I've talked a lot of sort of 18, 19, 20-year-olds in my job. And there's a kind of feeling or understanding amongst a lot of young people that it's only now that people have been progressive, right? That people care about black people and gay people and so on and so forth, right? And it's kind of like partly understandable, but it's not entirely true, right? People have had these concerns and been campaigning around these issues for decades, for generations, and so on. And they kind of think that, I think part of it is they think if something's wrong, if something you don't like and think is wrong, it should be a crime, because there's no politics anymore. It's like in the past, you'd join an anti-racist campaign, or you would join this group or that group, and you would campaign, you would argue, you would understand that's what you do, right? But now you don't really do that. So if there's anything you think is you don't like, and someone says, well, we should have a law against that, and it's just a, yeah, we should have a law against that. I think, yeah, but what are the implications of that? You know, don't you realize? So if you ask young people, do you think racism should be illegal? They'll just say yes, right? Without thinking about it. Yes, it should be illegal. Yeah, but that's an opinion, isn't it? It's a view, right? What happens if the racists get in? Could they say anti-racists should be illegal? You know, what happens then? How does that work in society? How do you have freedom? How do you have debate? How do you change people's minds? Is there not another way? And increasingly, it seems, no, there's not another way. You use law. And that's exactly what happens in Scotland all the time. They say, the two things they say is, we need to send out a message and we need to change the culture, right? Because in other words, we're going to use law, the police, prisons, force, state violence, if you like, to force you to have the correct opinions. That is deeply worrying, you know, deeply authoritarian, and that is really where Scotland is at the minute.
I have a question for you from Elizabeth, who's Dutch. She wonders if there's any talk in Scotland or any concern that the law might be used to derail politicians who are considered a threat to democracy, to sideline them. So she's given a couple of examples here. One of them I'm familiar with, another one I'm not. She talks about Dries van Langehoven in Belgium. He was sentenced to 8 months in jail for a meme posted by somebody else on his closed chat group on Facebook. And then you have Gideon van Meeren in the Netherlands, a member of the parliament. He's in trouble. He's in court over a few words in a speech. So any concerns that they might use it to go after political opponents?
No, absolutely. I mean, we've already seen this. I mean, you'll be aware of the Murdo Fraser, the Conservative. So yeah. In case people don't know this, this is a Conservative MSP who said something, you know, that some people think is offensive about transgenderism. And a transgender activist contacted the police, and it was recorded against his name as a non-crime hate incident. And he's a politician. He was just saying something. I think he might have even said it in the Scottish Parliament. So it's entirely possible that, because you know who they're going to go after, right? Conservatives, boo, you know, Greens, hooray. You know, it's like there are good people, there are bad people. And if I mean, you think about I mean, there's this comedy song out at the minute that Elon Musk put out about everyone's far right. This idea that just about everything is far right today. So once you're labelled as being far right, you know, that's you, you know. It's like it's open season. And I entirely think it is possible that people who have got right, who are far right, or even just, you know, seen as right on the political spectrum, could be targeted, entirely possible. And this is now a framework. It's like, because when they say, as I was saying before, the idea of a reasonable person, it's no longer a reasonable person as in the common man. It's now the reasonable member of the elite. And what they think, and what they think, is that the common man needs to have his values changed. You know, so it's a kind of, it's a complete upside down idea of what the reasonable person test in law was about, which was that this is what a commonly held perception, whereas now in Scotland, they want to change what they see as commonly held perceptions because they themselves are so separated off and have this different kind of value system. So yeah, entirely possible. And I'd say the law's there now, so God knows where it's going to end up.
That's as good a place as any to leave it for today. Look, obviously, you'll be back on talking about this and other issues in the future. Always love having you on. Stuart Wayton, Scottish Union for Education.substack.com, criminologist, lecturer, author. He's done it all. He's never played up front for Newcastle or for Sunderland. Come here and I tell you, just very briefly, we've got 30 seconds left. Again, I was dismayed today at just how gullible people are. Ali McCoist, now I'm not a Celtic fan and I'm not a Catholic either. I'm an agnostic, lapsed Catholic. But Ali McCoist was, he's as worried about these laws as you are and as I am. And he said, you know, he'd be interested to see what happens at Ibrox this coming weekend, Celtic Rangers in a big title showdown. And a lot of Celtic fans and others got the wrong end of the stick completely and weighed in with, tweets about, you know, bigotry and all this sort of nonsense. They didn't really see what it was that McCoist was saying. Do you think it might be an interesting weekend with that game in particular and this new law? Or will the police just let it go by, do you think?
Well, again, it's because it's in the political spotlight.
Yeah.
I think the police are going to take it easy, you know, come back in a year's time when it's died down a bit. And they've always struggled with football fans because there's a lot of them.
Yeah,
and
too many.
The question is, are you going to arrest everybody? And of course, football fans now put little things over their mouths and cover their so that you can't actually be picked up by cameras. So,
yeah.
You know, I would be surprised if they weighed in on this one. But again, give it time. Anything is possible.
Great to have you back, Stuart. Thanks, mate. Speak again soon.
Great. Cheers.
Bye for now. Stuart Wayton, Scottish Union for Education. Check out the Substack. I'll put the links, of course, on the podcast notes a bit later on. It's coming up for 6 minutes past the hour. I've told the story once or twice over the years. It's a very brief story. I'll tell you again. The first I came across, so we are where we are now. So governments, parliaments are trying to legislate for hate speech and trying to police people's thoughts. I suppose for me, the first I was aware of any such thing happening was when I was living in London doing a TV show for David Icke's People's Voice. And David was sharing an apartment with Caroline and myself. David managed to get a couple of tickets for the England-Germany friendly at Wembley. So this was in late 2013. Anyway, so we went along. I think Gareth came as well and Jamie, I think. David and myself, yeah, I think there was four of us. So we went to where we had nice seats, a lovely bit of football, happy days. And just before kickoff, the gigantic screens at either end of Wembley Stadium flashed up a message with a number and said, if you heard anything hateful or anything racist or anything homophobic, you should discreetly text to the number giving them details and the seat number of the person you were accusing of saying something hateful. And when this flashed up, David Icke looked at me, I looked at him, and we stared at each other. Because this was the first we'd ever heard of anything like that. And he said, have I Can I believe my eyes, Rich? He said. I said, you can. They're inviting us to rat out fellow football supporters if we think they've said something that could be construed as racist or homophobic. It was madness. That was the first time, really. Yeah, we're living in some times. 8 minutes it is past the hour. Some reggae. I like a bit of reggae. I don't know if this is cultural appropriation, you know. It might be. This is Aswad. John Waters, political candidate these days, after this. It is just gone past 10 minutes after 6, Wednesday, the 3rd of April, 2024. It's the Richie Allen Show, live from Salford City, in the heart of Salford City, it must be said. My guest for the rest of this hour needs even very little introduction. He's a good pal, even though we've never met face to face. He's an Irish writer. Books, of course, broadsheet media, broadcaster. He's done it all, has John. He's got a brilliant Substack account. I highly recommend you subscribe to it. It's johnwaters.substack.com. I was surprised and I wasn't. And I was surprised and I wasn't, genuinely. When a mutual friend of ours said, Richie, you're not going to believe it, but John has thrown his hat, the cliches now, they are vomiting forth here. Don't be a cliche monster. John's entering the field of politics. He's going to run in the EU elections, the forthcoming EU elections back home in Ireland. That will be in June. And he's going to tell us why. Let's welcome back to the programme our friend John Waters. Welcome back, John. How are you?
Thanks. Thanks, Richie. You're probably nearly as surprised as I was, you know, because I surprised myself. Because I had, this isn't my first time, you know. I ran in the general election in February 2020, in my local constituency here in Dublin, which is a really stupid thing to do. I ran at Dunleary, the most liberal, so-called, pseudo-liberal, I call it, constituency in Ireland. And I ran, and I got nearly 1,000 votes, Richie, which is, as somebody pointed
it's
out
bloody
to me,
good.
A medium-sized village in Mayo, you know. And I could be the Lord Mayor and the Emperor of such a village if I could find it on those votes, you know. So, but I swore on a dozen Bibles I would never run again. And I meant it. But I came under, attention, let's say, from a bunch of people down the West who had done some research and had formed the view that I could win a seat in the European elections in the constituency of, it's called Midlands Northwest. And it's basically, it's more than half of the territory of Ireland. It goes from Malinhead and Donegal, straight down all along the west coast, all around down to Galway, and then straight across the Midlands to Louth, and includes Kildare and Monaghan and Cavan and Longford and all those Midland counties. So it's a huge tranche. And actually, it includes my heartland. I mean, where I grew up, where I went to work for the first few years of my working life in Mayo, in Roscommon, where I grew up, where my father came from in Sligo, where I go there a lot now. Donegal, where even though I have no particular connection in blood terms, or I am connected to it in a certain sense, ideologically, if that's the right word, which it isn't. But the people of Donegal and I have always found, you know, common cause on most issues, because they were like an independent nation in Ireland for many elections, many referendums in the last couple of decades. And I always found a great welcome there. And of course, Galway is a place that was where we all loved to go when we were kids, young fellas, you know, and going to dances in Sea Point and so on. And so I kind of said, well, I said no first. I said no twice. Absolutely not at the first time. Then no. And the third time I came back, it was put to me that we were within a month of this referendum that has, you know, rocked the state to its foundation, shall we say. And I had been out there campaigning on that and doing videos and talking. I was talking to you about it a couple of times, I think. And they put it to me this way. Look, why don't we wait till the 9th of March, the day of the count, and we'll see what the result is. We believe it's going to be a no-no. And if it is, would that change things? And I said, I don't know. And anyway, so we did. And I decided, okay, I'll do it.
Brilliant.
That it struck me when I started to look at that, because that vote, Richie, was astonishing, because I thought we were going to win. I thought maybe one no or maybe two no's, but I thought it'd be tight. I thought it'd be kind of 51-49 or 52-48, something like that. Like 70-30 didn't dawn on me, nor did it dawn on anybody else, Richie, that I know of. No. And what that convinced me of, Richie, was that we'd been fundamentally wrong in some of our evaluation of the state of the nation, the psyche of the nation, where we formed the view that a lot of people were just asleep. They didn't know what was going on, and they were too hypnotized and propagandized to understand. And what it was really is the other thing that I've been talking about is just the mutism, which is like that kind of that people being silenced by the hostility in the public realm, the thuggery in the public realm, the menaces in the public realm over the last 10 years, where people were attacked for even thinking of something which wasn't approved of by the elite and the political ascendancy, the regime, and their proxy warriors on the streets. And that it struck me that actually, as it struck me when I was in the voting, the polling booth, not that it's a booth anymore, it's just a little table at the side, that morning, that when you got your voting paper from the woman at the table and you went over into the corner to the shelf where you have the pencil and the tied to a string still, you know, which is great to see that, and you put the X on the paper. It struck me standing there looking down and nobody near me. I could crunch over it so no one could see what I was doing. And it struck me, this is the last vestige of the Irish Republic here, right here, this spot. This is where people have the opportunity to say what they really feel. And I thought about that afterwards, and I thought, there's a lot more going on in the psyche of Paddy than I thought right now. So I'll give it a lash.
And while you were doing that, while you were putting that X, like you said already, it didn't occur to you two resounding wins. And this might be indicative of a shift, a mental shift, a collective shift in the thinking of Irish people, and maybe a growing realisation that what they thought they thought they lived in a democracy. They thought they lived in a place that was fundamentally fair, even if it was flawed. And now, because of what has happened in the last 3.5 years, and there's so many aspects to this, and we've covered quite a lot of them in the last couple of years, you and me here. There's obviously the vaccine injuries, the insane immigration policies that the country is currently operating. All of these things squeezing people. I mean, you've got the same problems in Ireland as we do in the UK. Massive waiting lists for people for routine tests, which, you know, could be, John, I suppose, death sentences for people not getting these routine tests. Yes. They need, so all this stuff is all coming together. And the Irish people gave more than a bloody nose to the government, didn't they? A couple of weeks ago,
They sure did. And when you see that, in a sense, when I was in that corner, I was kind of like whispering my no, as it were. But together, all those whispers became a massive roar on Saturday noon, you know. And because I was at a wedding that day, and I wasn't even, it got out of my head, believe it or not, you know, because we were, you know, what weddings are like. And the next thing, my phone rang, and it was a friend from back in one of the Rossies back home. And he says, "It's a resounding no, John. It's a resounding no." I said, I nearly fainted. And I shouted across to my wife, "No, it's no." And everybody sort of stood between us, paralyzed, looking at me. And like, you wouldn't know where they might stand. You know, there might have been some of the essence. But the thing was, that afternoon, then I heard Radker, you know, somebody, he was talking about it. And he was saying that, oh, well, you know, this won't really have impact on the election. You know, it's a different matter altogether, you know, and this sort of stuff. And I was thinking, is that true? And in a certain sense, it is true, Richie. It could be true, because in historically, a lot of these kind of issues, no matter how strong people might feel about them, don't necessarily register as you might think in a general election or whatever. And there are all kinds of complicated reasons for that. But one of the reasons that struck me immediately was, why is that now? Because on the conventional voting paper, there's no opportunity to say no. There's no none of the above. You know, which is kind of what you would want. So what I said, well, in the context of being asked to run for the European Parliament, I thought, well, maybe I can be that no. maybe I can be that box that people can cross and say, that's my no. He's going to go to the European Parliament and say, no way, baby, no way.
And the wonderful thing is, if, and I mean, I hope, and you're no idiot, you've been around the block plenty of times, so you know your onions. So if these people believe they've done the metrics and they say John's got a good chance, the wonderful thing is, if you are returned as a member of the European Parliament for Midlands North West, you'll be able to reach far more people. I mean, I know your Substack is very well. I'm not just buttering you up. I'm not kissing your arse. You've got a lot of Substack followers, and you're known as a writer and as a journalist, of course. But you'll be able to reach a lot more people. This is the thing, isn't it? People will be able to hear whatever they might do with what they hear, you know, but at least they'll be able to hear dissent, genuine dissent.
You see, that's very critical, Richie, in this sense. I mean, in lots of different senses, but in this particular sense, that, you see, this vote kind of tells you something that kind of we know ourselves from our own experience. You know that sense you have, that you have an intuition, and you're looking around for affirmation from your neighbours, from people in the street, from people, and you're maybe testing it out in a tentative way, you know, saying things like, you know, ah, that was an interesting referendum, wasn't it, you know, and seeing that you might get a clue as to how they were going on it, you know, and next thing you're in a conversation, or you're running away from them, like, you know, and that's kind of what I think one of the roles of somebody like a politician in that context. I hate the word politician. I dread. I'm for the moment on a temporary basis. I'm calling myself a citizen politician, but you know that you have that opportunity to affirm people, to say things that if they hear them, they'll say, that's what I think. Gosh, I'm not alone. I'm not crazy. Well, he might be crazy, but you know. You know, crazier than me. Like, you know what I mean? But once you hear it from somebody else, and then that's the way the contagion might start. And that's all we need, really, because that's what's been missing in the last 4 years. That has been the nature of the pseudo-reality they've constructed around us, whereby they shut down all alternative perspectives, silence people, or else if they didn't silence them, they demonize them in all kinds of ways, as they did to myself and Jim O'Doherty when we took our legal challenge, you know, made us into kind of idiots, like, who didn't know what we were doing, this kind of, without telling people a single sentence from what we'd actually submitted to the courts, interestingly, you know. Like, I don't mind them calling me us idiots if they're pointing to the idiot-y bit that they're talking about, but they weren't able to do that, you see. So that affirmation, I think, is critical, you know. It's like, that's how we affirm things. That's how, like, the way we kind of understand what's going on around us is more complex than I think we ever gave it credit for. You know, we kind of think you kind of just look at the newspaper, listen to the 9 o'clock news or the 6 o'clock news, and that's how you know what's going on in your country. But it's not. You affirm things in all kinds of ways. Like, you know, if somebody, you know, if you meet someone in the street and say, you know, that, oh, the president of France is after being assassinated, then you say, oh God, that's terrible. And you go home, you're going home. And then you switch on the television and there's nothing on the television news about it. You think, God, that fella must be soft in the head, you know. You kind of affirm things. And then you might find, actually, no, the news has suppressed it, as it might very likely do now, of something of that, you know, gravity, depending on how it sat with their agendas. So it's much more important now, I think, that kind of independent voice in the political life of nations and of Europe, to have people who are different, who will actually commandeer that place, that space, stand up for their given number of minutes and say things that people over there don't want to hear, that Ursula von der Leyen doesn't want to hear you say in the European Parliament chamber. That's the victory. That's what this is about for me. And of course, you know, by doing that, by extension, on different platforms around Europe and talking to other representatives, I'm assuming already, I mean, like, Richie, you can understand, you know, my colleagues, you know, in the European Parliament, and that we're...
I love it. This is positive thinking. The Americans love this, by the way. This is brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
This is how you got to talk.
As you say, Roscommon, we weren't very strong on the positive thinking, you know, over the years, but I'm getting in on it now, because there's no alternative, you know. You either go with the doomsday cult, or you take them on. and you say, "No way, Jose." That might be my slogan. I'm thinking, "No way, Jose," you know. So I'm kind of getting used to it now. I mean, to be honest, I'm shocked at myself, you know, because I had really said it 100 times, no way was I ever going to run again, because the last episode was really miserable, not just for me, but for my poor wife, who was out in the mornings with a couple of friends of hers, like standing at dart stations and around Dunleary getting abused by people, you know, because she was married to me, you know. And because I was ill, I really was, like, I got very ill just the year before and I wasn't fit to do anything. But this time I'm a lot stronger and we have 2 months to do it and 9 more weeks. And the vibe is very good so far, Richie. I mean, I'm getting feedback. Even in Dublin, people are coming up to me and saying, you know, they're going to vote me. And I say, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to move to Kildare.
You're going to have to move, yeah.
Yeah, and they're absolutely devastated to hear it, you know. And they're wondering maybe they could stay with their cousins or something, you know, and vote for me then, you know.
It's going to be a fascinating 8-9 weeks for you, particularly when it comes to the media, because I don't know if things have changed in Ireland, but when I was producing mid-morning talk radio at WLR-FM, I was very surprised during the first election cycle that I worked how diligent, how stringent the rules were around equal access and equal time. And my presenter, the late Billy McCarthy, God rest him, Billy said to me, "Richie, these are the laws," and he gave me the Broadcasting Commission of Ireland's laws, and he said, "You know, even some bloke, Richie, who's just running as an independent, and you never see him, you never hear him, he's got to be given equal time. You've got to, with a stopwatch, we had to do this during the, you know, what was given over as the election cycle." He said, "Right, here's the cycle." I think it was 4 or 5 yeah. weeks. So, will this be afforded to you now? Will you be able to get on media back home?
Well, this is a really interesting question, Richie. Yeah. In different ways than the one you mean. It is interesting in the way you mean it, but it's interesting in another way as well. Because when I was taking this on, I had to kind of spell out certain conditions to my, you know, whatever you would call them. They're not sponsors, they're minders or something. And the people who wanted me to run and who were prepared to canvass for me and put out the word for me. And one of these conditions was that I don't really want to have anything to do with mainstream media. I can't be obliged to truck with these guys who have been telling lies for the last 4 years and calling anybody who told the truth a conspiracy theorist, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean that very sincerely. And nothing personal type of thing, you know. But there's a dilemma. And for the reason that you say, like, if they're obliged to do this, this is going to really make their lives difficult, which is, you know, maybe a good thing in another sense. But what has been occurring to me the last few days, because I have had a couple of texts from people in the local radio sector and maybe local newspapers and things like that. And you see, the trouble is, Richie, that I'm kind of vindictively saying I'm not going on with you. I mean, it's that, what do you go on and talk to those people about when you have two entirely different versions of the world?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like they've been saying everything. I've been telling people what's really going on, and these people have been vociferously denying it because they're being paid by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, that exact august body that you just mentioned, which I was a member of for 10 years or so, right? And these people, they're now paying 100 grand per month or something to every radio station, provided you put out the propaganda and you don't cover the excess debts. And I've gone through this with people who have been trying to get these bodies to actually act on foot of, you know, their information they've gathered, the data they've been gathering. They've submitted it to the Broadcasting Authority. The Broadcasting Authority have told them in the most incredible terms, Richie, in one case in particular, you know, where a man from Kilkenny, Patrick E. Walsh, a wonderful guy, who's an accountant, who's been doing
nice fella,
the response he got from the Broadcasting Authority was, "Oh, it's not our remit to investigate things that are not on radio or not on the media. Our job is only to regulate what's on it." Yeah. So if they don't report something, that's not the business of the Broadcasting Authority at all.
Which I understand now. You might be dismayed to hear me say this. I understand. I don't want the Broadcasting Authority to be telling radio stations what they should and shouldn't cover. However, I hear where you're coming from. Can I ask you to go back 40 seconds? And some of our listeners won't be familiar with radio stations and TV, and newspapers getting money from the government around issues of health. You said 100,000. Remind us, what's that all about?
They're during the whole pandemic. Do you remember, was there a pandemic or something a few years ago?
Apparently. People were talking about.
and they were, so they because the conventional advertising, etc., was reduced or something, they were getting periodic grants. All the stations, the local stations, were getting periodic grants, and you would see them in the they would send out a bulletin of a list of stations that got 100 grand was a standard. I don't know if it was necessarily every month, but it was every couple of months that stations got this boost. And but you see, they only got it obviously so long as they played the ball.
It was furlough money. We could call it furlough money. That's what it was.
That was more or less the idea. But to go back to your point, Richie, I understand again what you're saying there, and that's the point they're making. But I would say that if you're talking about the matter of news and you're talking about standards and ethics in respect of that, it's not a question then purely in the normative way of forcing them to do things, to put things on the radio that they don't want to put on or they don't feel is appropriate from a programming point of view. This is actually refusing to report a really important life and death story in your society while still claiming to be a news service.
Oh, it's morally reprehensible. I totally agree with you. In fact, I was asked, I don't do interviews very often because I don't have time, and I'm not a researcher, I'm not an activist, I'm not a genius like you, and I'm not, for the second time I'll say, I'm not kissing your arse. I'm a journalist. I prefer to be doing the interviewing. But I did do an interview last year with an Irish independent lady whose name escapes me, and I said, look, we talked about this very thing actually. I said, if I was given the running of the Broadcasting Authority in Ireland, I would introduce new rules around public access like they have in some states in America and some parts of Australia, where you've got to give over some of your programming to people who want to raise issues that you can't be bothered your bloody arse to cover. Now that is what I would introduce. And then I would have strict regulations within that, where that if a member of the public could demonstrate to me, as a regulator, that they had repeatedly tried to get access to this because they wanted to talk about a public health emergency, well, I would come down on the broadcaster, whether it be WLRFM or Red FM in Cork, like a ton of bricks. I'd love to see something like that introduced.
I agree with you, Richie, and that's a very interesting idea and a very good one. But I don't know if it would necessarily answer this, because there would be a selection process.
Of course.
That would be opened into whatever, the manipulation or selectivity or whatever. But you could actually, off the top of my head now, I won't come up with a particularly good analogy, but you could come up with, I'm sure, if you had time to think about it, with really good analogies to show the absurdity of what the Broadcasting Authority was suggesting in responding to Patrick E. Walsh in that fashion.
It's ridiculous,
because, for example, if some momentous event occurred in the society, supposing the president, God help us and God forbid, was assassinated, and the next morning, then a particular radio station just refused to publish that. And they start the news off with, it's going to be very showery in the afternoon.
Climate change,
Yeah, or something. And there was a complaint about that. I'm pretty sure the Broadcast Authority would uphold the complaint.
Yes, they would, because it's in the public interest. It's beyond being in the public interest. It is an emergency, and it must be. Yeah, absolutely. And excess deaths are an emergency. You're right. Listen, absolutely.
It's a complete nonsense. I mean, what's not on the television in terms of news is a programming, ethical programming matter. And that's all they need to be interested in.
Yeah, I can't argue with it. It sickens me to see this. Look, I've interviewed journalists on this programme, people who worked for the tabloids here in the UK, and they spent parts of 2020 bringing very serious stories about vaccine injuries and about, do not resuscitate notices put on patients for no reason. And every single tabloid said, no. It's horrible. And Patrick, it's horrible. I'm not standing up for the Broadcasting Authority at all. You're absolutely right. It is inexplicable why the media wouldn't want to cover the greatest public emergency health emergency in our lifetime. Well, absolutely.
In a certain sense, though, Richie, it's not inexplicable.
It actually
tells you that this is what they know to be the truth.
Yeah.
You know, like, because if you're a detective and you're investigating a crime and you go to the house or you think the perpetrators are there and you put out a few scenarios to them, you know, and the one they don't actually give any credence to whatsoever is the one that implicates themselves.
Yeah.
You might be inclined to say, there's something absolutely bizarre about this. If you have a multiple choice answer to a particular question and people are deliberately covering over one option and ruling it out of the discussion from the start without proffering any evidence and coming up then with nonsensical explanations for what's happened. For example, in the excess debt thing now, the latest one now I hear is light pollution. That's the thing. If you live in an area where there's a lot of light at night, you know, and you can't see the stars, you're much more likely to get a heart attack or a stroke, apparently, than if you lived out in the middle of the country, out in the middle of Sligo or somewhere like that, you know.
It's madness, isn't it?
It is utter insanity. And yet, you know, the fact that an untested experimental injection was given to 90% of populations in a particular time, and those figures coincide with the rollout of that particular injection, surely there's a prima facie case for at least an investigation into that.
Nothing to see here, says the Irish government. Nothing to see here, says the Irish media. John Waters is our guest. John will stand. He's standing as a candidate to be the MEP, one of the MEPs for Midlands North West in Ireland. John Waters, .substack.com. It's always a pleasure to have you on. I'm going to throw you a curveball now, nothing to do with politics. I was listening to Joe Rogan interview Ray Kurzweil. Kurzweil is the AI guy, isn't he? He's the top man in E7. That's right. He said something during the conversation with Joe Rogan. I'm going to do something on it tomorrow on the show. And it embarrassed me, because if I should know this, I'm embarrassed. I've either got onset dementia or my memory is gone. He said that artificial intelligence played a huge role in the development of Moderna's mRNA jab. And I didn't know this. Did you know that? They used artificial intelligence.
I didn't know that, Richie. I didn't. I'm not hugely shocked by it.
A little bit. He kind of explained it. He said, we ran billions of possibilities, mRNA codes and strands, through using AI. We took out then what it gave us. And then for 10 months, he said, he kept saying we. For 10 months then, throughout 2020, based on what AI had told us, we then went into testing for 10 months before the jabs went live in late 2020, early 2021. It was news to me, and it kind of did shake me a little bit. I thought, I don't ever remember reading anything about this.
And did he, Richie, did he deal then with the actual consequences of this?
No, because Joe Rogan, because while Joe Rogan is an interesting listen, because he's an entertaining lad, he's a comedian and actor, and he's a MMA, is it, mixed martial arts? Joe's all right, he's a good listen. He's not a journalist, Joe, and he didn't jump all over him. I mean, the minute he said AI was involved and basically Ray Kurzweil was involved, I would have been all over him like a rash, as you would have been.
You see, this is why I've never been a fan of Joe Rogan. I mean, I've seen clips here and there, and I've seen with different people, and if I hear if he's on with someone, Elon Musk or Jordan Peterson, I'll have a look at that. But he's not sharp.
No, he's not sharp.
He kind of might be having a smoke while he's talking. You know,
he likes a bit of weed, he does. Yeah.
And that's always a red light warning thing. You know, But you see, this is again, you know, for where we are, and this is one of the terrifying things now, Richie, that we've talked about before, that we are in an era of artificial intelligence, of algorithms, of neural networks, all this kind of stuff, which is owned and controlled by a tiny, tiny cadre of entrepreneurs, multi-billionaires, etc., in Silicon Valley. And that was done by stealth, as I've said to you before, over a period of about 40 to 50 years. They went underground in the 80s with all that. And they went into their bunkers and they were developing all this stuff, which had would have the capacity, they knew, to engage in mass surveillance, mass kind of punishment of people, mass of dragooning of people, totalitarian impositions and all that, as well as this other stuff. Data collection, harvesting, you know, like gathering information about people that they don't even have themselves through reflections of other people they know and all of that, you know, gathering all that kind of, accumulating all that information in order to create a massive control grid, which is essentially, you know, where communism wanted to go, where fascism wanted to go, but never really succeeded for very long. But what they're trying to do now is install this permanently as a digital grid. And that was all done over and above the heads of the democratic remit of the people. No, there was no consultation. It was essentially taken out of their sight, taken away into the bunkers. And then 25 or 30 years later, the boys came out, led by Henry Kissinger, the last act of his was to announce that now they had it all ready to go and we should just sit tight and listen up.
Accept it. Did you come across this? You correct me now if I got this wrong. I don't think I am getting it wrong. Data centers, which are these vast, big warehouses where they've got all of this hardware to store and process data. Somebody told a Sky News presenter this week that in the very near future, more than half the world's electricity supply will be used in keeping these data centers going.
That's correct.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And already that's happening in Ireland, like where the grid, you know, can go down for private usage because of the need for these data centers to be going 24 hours
a
day.
That's madness, John.
It's beyond. You see, this is another symptom of the thing I've been writing a lot about and trying to get across to people, that such a radical change has occurred in the world. You know, like, you go back 2019, a friend of mine, he's a follower of mine, he's a beautiful singer and he writes songs. And he wrote a song once, which knew, like there about 3 years ago. Christy Bracken is his name. And he's a man of about my own age or older, you know. And he wrote a song called I Remember 2019. And even the title wiped me out, Richie, you know. Oh, God almighty. What a powerful title, because he was essentially talking about that moment, that pivotal moment, changed the world, changed everything, brought us into an entirely new world in which all the things that we believed all our lives were set and fixed permanently, were basically evaporated. And we lived in this new world, which was run not to democratic principles, not to concepts of freedom, not to concepts of that we thought we understood from theology and philosophy and so on and so on. All that was gone. And that's really the thing that really irks me so much about the media treatment, that this is their job, not just to tell the people the bald news about what happened yesterday, you know, whatever the economics are and road accidents or whatever it would be, but to actually lead a conversation about vital issues in relation to humanity. And they have ceased to do this, except to pummel them with propaganda, mostly lies concerning things like climate change or whatever it is, and give them no opportunity to offer dissent or contradiction or question. And these events are the most momentous probably in the entire history of the human race. And they have taken us from a period of relative freedom and, you know, adequate, let's say, democracy, to basically totalitarianism.
In a fell swoop. Yeah.
Yes.
In that time period.
Yes.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I was pleasantly surprised yesterday. An author who's a pretty loud voice in the Climate Change is Real Brigade actually came on and stayed on the programme with me yesterday for a robust exchange about the rights and wrongs of climate change. It cheered me up this week, really, you know,
yes.
Because previously most of these people would put you down with you're a crazy conspiracy theorist, but no, he came on, to be fair to him, and I thought, you know, just give me a little bit of hope, you know, because I think that's one of the things, the very first time we spoke, and you won't remember it because you do lots of interviews, the first time we spoke, we lamented how how quickly the old way of doing media just disappeared. Like, it would have been unthinkable back in the 70s and 80s that you just say to somebody, no, you're completely wrong, so therefore you don't get access, we don't listen. That just was untenable. I mean, even when I was producing talk radio in the 90s in Ireland, you know, we made sure that every idea, regardless of how preposterous we might have thought it was, but, you know, if somebody could articulate it, well, yeah, well, of course they can join in. You know, of course they can join in. Get them on. Let's put some sunlight on this theory and see how it goes. But now we don't, you know. It's just like that.
And it's very interesting, Richie. I know exactly what... Yeah, and of course, that's the ethic on which all journalism must predicate.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were a researcher on a radio program, which you were, your priority in preparing for tomorrow was not to line up people who agreed with your opinion.
No.
Or your station, or your boss's opinion, or whatever. It was to find the most disputatious bunch of people you could find so that you would have the best possible argument about whatever the hell it was.
Well said, John. Well said. And what we didn't do the American thing where people screamed at one another. We didn't do that. You're right, we found contrarians and, you know, vexatious and, as you said, disputatious people, and we said, right, let's have a go at it. But nobody was drowned out, and there were no grandstanding presenters like Piers, what a fucking wanker, Morgan. There was none of that. None of that.
Oh, he's a pain in the ass. You know, I can remember a moment, the moment probably in time, Richie, when I first noticed that that was changing, and it really alarmed me. I was in a place, I'll tell you what it was. It was in December 2011. I'm pretty sure that was the date, 2011. And I was actually a member of the Broadcasting Authority at the time. And they were having a kind of an open house forum in a theatre in Dublin. And Smock Alley, it was called. And they were inviting all these, what they call stakeholders, you know, in interested in the question in broadcasting. And there was there for various lobby groups and political parties and all. I was listening to, there was different people talking, and there was an LGBT group, and there was a climate change group, and there was, you know, and I was listening to all their contributions. And after about the course of an hour of listening to about three or four of these, something hit me. That every single one of them were demanding that their issue be allowed to go through untested.
Untested.
That they were sick and tired of having to debate with people who disagree with them. And the opinion polls had decided the issue and we should just do it. And I stood up and I said, hang on a minute. No, the people have a right to speak. If you, and this was in the particular context of the LGBT guy who had said, oh, the people now agree with us, so let's just do it. I said, no, the Constitution defines marriage in a certain way. If you want to change the Constitution, there's a way that you can go about it. You put your proposal together, and if it's accepted, it's put up for referendum, and then we have the right to argue it for a particular period of time. And you don't have the right to silence us. We can question it. The people have the right to defend their constitution as it is, because that's the will of the people as of today. You can change it, but you have to go about it in this way.
You have to win the argument. You have to argue.
That's what I got to be called a homophobe for.
Oh, Jesus, yeah. Yeah. It's mad. And I was talking to Stuart Waiton before you came on. Stuart's an academic and broadcaster, writes for the Daily Mail. He runs the Scottish Union for Education. Scottish Union for Education is campaigning for sanity to return to Scotland schools, basically, you know, not these crazy programmes. And we were talking about this new hate speech law, which went live in Scotland on April Fool's Day, which is just beyond tyranny, really, where you could be done if somebody says that your conduct in an argument about Brexit, about the Irish referendums, was motivated by hatred of their protected characteristic. Therefore, you might need Plaid to come and knock on your door and question you about it. That's where it led to what you saw in 2011, which terrified you because you are a Democrat. I don't mean in terms of any party, but you're a man who believes in debate and transparency and openness. You saw that in 2011. Only 13 years later, we have that lunatic law in Scotland now. Isn't it mental, isn't it?
It is absolutely mental. And I mean, essentially, they can read your mind and decide that's what you meant. That's what you said. That's what you were feeling. And therefore, you now have a quasi-criminal record, to the extent that whereas you may not be prosecuted in the conventional way, the record will remain and will be open to prospective employers or others who may wish to vet you, and they will see this and make their own conclusions from it. This is beyond unimaginable by our lifetime standards. We just cannot really get our heads. I can't get my head around this. See, because I come from a tradition in journalism, which I didn't know it for a long time, and I didn't. It took me, you know, I just stumbled across it. But the principle underlying journalism all of our lives in Western civilization has been that which was set down by John Stuart Mill over 100 years ago, which was the basis that free speech, which was that he said, if every member of society, save one person, thinks one thing, and that one person thinks something entirely different, then that society has a greater interest in hearing that one person's point of view than it has in hearing all of the others. Because that one person, if he is wrong, well, the discussion, the debate will enable the society to verify its convictions and to be certain that it has made no error in the matter in question. And if he is right, he will save that, he has a chance of saving that society from outright destruction. Now, that's long lost in a society which actually will pick out certain characteristics of the facial appearance of people, the nature of their hair, their sexual proclivities, and give them an exalted status in that society, whereby they are above criticism, above jocularity, above commentary, above, you know, questioning, by virtue of those characteristics, which are actually called protected characteristics, as far as I understand. Certainly in Irish law, that's what they are. Yeah, these laws here are all dissimilar. So that means that, you know, if you have a particular shade of a face, you have the capacity to criminalize me on the basis of your sense, your intuition about what my attitude is to you, by the way I look at you, maybe, or the way I say, could you get out of my way, please?
Yeah. Microaggressions, John. Microaggressions.
Yes. And this can become a quasi criminal offence.
Yeah.
This is how bad. Like you see, Richie, we ran out of words for all this stuff a long time ago. Like, you know, you can say this is crazy, you can say it's mad, you can say it's deranged, you can say it's unhinged. But what use are those words in the face of such
they don't
energy?
Mean they've lost all meaning. I was thinking as you were talking there, if Orwell and Huxley and others were in purgatory having a look at this, they might be shaking their heads saying, didn't see this, you know. I mean, this is beautiful, you know.
I've read, Orwell was one of the three major writers in my life when I was a young fella, you know. Patrick Kavanagh was another, and Dylan Thomas was a third. But, you know, George Orwell was very, I read everything that he wrote, and everything about him, and about everything he wrote. And I often think about this now, and it strikes me that if George Orwell was here, for all that he was his understanding, he would be confounded by what's happening. he would be silenced,
yeah,
in the sense that he wouldn't know what to say. What? How do you begin to describe such absurdities?
Absurdities
is the least description of them in a certain sense. They're obscenities. Where would you start to satirize them? I mean, where would you go to do a satire of that?
Well, this is where we've got to leave it, because I've got to wrap up and get out now. We're nearly at the end of the programme. Look, do come back before the election, won't you? You can come back anytime you want.
Hopefully it'll still be I'll still be cheerful and you know.
You won't be knackered, yeah.
Yeah. And thank you so much, Richie. I'm much obliged to you again.
Give over. It's johnwaters.substack.com. John is standing for MEP for Midlands Northwest. Go and say hello to him on Substack. Subscribe to him. Help him out. And we'll obviously follow it. And John will be back on before then. Always a pleasure, mate. Thanks for today. I'll speak soon.
Bye.
Thanks, John. Bye for now. John Waters on Wednesday's Richie Allen Show. Thanks to John. Lots of comments came in there. Sorry I can't read them. But listen, I've had about three today messages from people who say they can't access the Richie Allen Show on Apple Podcast. Now, Catherine is the latest one. I can find you on Podomatic, she says. I haven't been able to get it on Apple since March 27th, but all my other shows on Apple are still available. It seems weird. And I've had several, three, in fact, similar messages. So those listeners who normally get it on Apple, can you send me a message to tell me if you're still getting it on Apple? Just let me know if you are. I have a feeling I know why this is happening. It's because I bragged about the chart position of the Richie Allen Show. Now, don't dismiss that as fanciful. It happened last year. Last year, the show started showing up in the 30s. In the daily charts, because they are published daily for Apple's iTunes, because the show's got a lot of listeners, right? I'm not bragging about that, you know that. And I, not because I'm a dickhead with a big ego, I wanted to wind up some of the most well-known presenters in the UK and say, how is it that a guy working out of, you know, his home, out of a bedroom in Salford, with no money, with no advertising, with no cross promotion, how is it that I can beat you? So I bragged about this last year. And then the show disappeared out of the charts completely, which is absolutely ridiculous. But then earlier this year, the show started showing up in the charts again. So it's like somebody took the brakes off and would regularly now be in the top 60 for the whole of the UK, beating some of the biggest names in UK radio. And again, that's not a brag, that's just a fact. And I bragged about it again recently. It sounds like I'm contradicting myself. I'm not really. But just to wind people up, just to get a rise out of them. In fact, what I was trying to do was to get some mainstream media coverage of the Richie Allen Show. I thought by bragging about this that I might get a mention in the Daily Mail or I might get a mention in the Guardian or something. It turns out I didn't. So if I'm not showing up on Apple and if you're not getting my show on Apple, as you should be, because it is on Apple, I've got my own phone here and it's on Apple, maybe they're screwing with it again with the charts. They don't want me showing up in the charts, I think. Because it's preposterous, really, when you see the charts. You see all of these BBC shows, LBC, and right in the middle of it is the Richie Allen Show. And that wouldn't go down well in some quarters. That's my opinion. I could be talking shite. It might not be the reason. But I've had several messages today, three today, and I've had others from people telling me they can't get it on Apple. I think they're fudging the charts. And if they are, do you know what? There's nothing I can do about that. Nothing. Only take it up the backside. There's nothing I can do about it. But it wouldn't surprise me. They did it last year. How could it drop out of the charts completely last year? From a position of 30, right? Beating, as I said, some of these most well-known people. Very well-known shows. Regularly beating Piers Morgan. Regularly. All the LBC presenters, with the exception of O'Brien, to be fair to O'Brien. I don't think I've ever charted higher than him. But that doesn't go down well in some quarters, because they might think that by being in the charts, it might draw maybe people to listen to the show who might never have listened before. Maybe that's all I'm saying. Anyway, that is it for the programme. Thank you to Stuart Waiton, and thank you so much as well to John Waters. Until tomorrow, for me, the BBG, Sláinte Tomáil.